Okay, let's go ahead and open up to Matthew 23. We're really sailing through Matthew here. I was going to look on the internet. I don't know, does anyone know how long we've been in Matthew? I'm going to guess 2 years, but I suspect it might be longer than that. Well, we're getting near the end here. And today, I say this every week and never quite make it, but we're going to try and get through Matthew 23. It's not a particularly fun chapter. It's the woes on this vain religious system. I kind of look at it as a grand farewell to that vain religious system. He's just going to shoot off all the fireworks here. He's going to assign them through these woes to condemnation and judgment, and he's just going to be all done with them. And we can be all done with them too in Matthew 23, because then in Matthew 24, we go to the Olivet Discourse where he discusses future things, and then we go to the death of Christ and the resurrection of Christ. And then we'll be through Matthew. We'll have to find some other book to go through. So let's go ahead and look at Matthew 23. And it's important to realize that this vain religious system of Israel, while different in specifics, is really not very different, at least in generalities, than the vain religious system of Christianity. They all have the appearance of doing the things of God, relating the things of God, giving out the things of God, but they're really just keeping it for themselves, turning people away from God rather than to God, sending people down wrong avenues, keeping them out of God and his things rather than bringing them in. And so we can learn a lot from this. A vain religious system is a vain religious system, whether it's in the Israel's prophetic program or the Body of Christ mystery program. So as we see here, as we go through these, I'm going to list out, I think there's five groups of absurdities, and you can take those. They're not going to be the same in specifics, but they'll be the same general. They're the same absurdities of the vain religious system of what some people call Christendom. And of course, the emphasis they place is on the dumb at the end. So let's go ahead and open up to Matthew 23. All right, before we go into Matthew 23, I think you have to start with the last verse of Matthew 22. So let's just read that. Remember what he was doing in Matthew 22. He is silencing the vain religious system. He's silenced the chief scribes and the chief priests and scribes. He silenced the chief priests and the elders of the people. He silenced the Sadducees. He silenced the Herodians. He silenced the Pharisees. He silenced them all. Now you get to the last verse of chapter 22, right before we go into chapter 23, and he says, "And no man was able to answer him a word, neither did any man from that day forth ask him any more questions." They are silenced. Now go into chapter 23, and Jesus is going to tell them, "Listen to everything they're saying." And I think it's a sarcastic thing he's saying. He's just silenced them. And then Matthew opens up Matthew 23 and says, "Listen to everything they say." Well, they're not saying anything. He just silenced them in the end of chapter 22. So now let's pick it up in chapter 23. "Then spoke Jesus to the multitude and said to his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. And therefore, whatsoever they bid you observe, whatever they say to you, observe, that observe and do, but do not ye after their works, for they say and do not do." And I just think there's a little bit of humor he's bringing in here, because when you leave chapter 22, these people are silenced. And then Jesus says, "Listen to everything they're saying." Well, at this point, they're not saying anything. They've been silenced. So I personally think that this chapter opens up, Jesus is talking sarcastically. He's setting them up, listened to everything they said, but he's silenced them. They're not saying anything. And now in the next, especially the rest of the chapter to the end, he's going to look at what they do. And he's going to knock that down. He silenced them, everything they've said. And next he's going to silence all their works they do. And that's where these woes are going to come in. Now, of course, if you'd rather not think Jesus would talk sarcastically and you think he's talking straightforwardly here, then you'd have to narrow this down and qualify everything by Moses' seat. It's just going to be what they say when they're reciting or reading Moses' scriptures. And then in that sense, they were, of course, to listen to that. I don't think that's what he's talking about. I think he just spent a whole chapter silencing them. He says, now listen to what they're saying. They're not saying anything. He silenced them. And now he's going to show them what they're doing. And he's going to destroy them, condemn them, judge them based on what they're doing. And they're sitting, it says, sitting in Moses' seat. How did they get to sit there? How did they get the nation and the city and the temple? How did they get all that? They stole it from God and the people. That's the whole point of this vain religious system. They were supposed to be the conduit of God's riches and blessings to the nation. And instead, what was the situation in the nation? We saw this back in Matthew 4 at the very beginning of the book. The nation is in complete ruin. It's supposed to be God's people, God's nation. And there's God's kingdom. And all this is supposed to be going on. Instead, there's no peace. There's no shalom. There's no well-being. Spiritual, physical, psychological, social. The whole place is in ruins. This vain religious system has brought the nation, going all the way back to Isaiah, in the fifth course of punishment, where they've been under the curses of the law in this fifth course of punishment. The nation is a complete ruin. She's ruled by Gentiles. And who rules the Gentiles? Satan. She's under Satan's rule through the Gentiles. There's no health, wealth, or prosperity in Israel. Otherwise, they wouldn't be coming out in multitudes to be healed and fed. And the nation is in complete ruin. This vain religious system has stole the nation. It stole the city of Jerusalem. It stole the temple. And here, Jesus says they've stolen Moses' seat. And the point of this is, for those who have been following along in our study here, going all the way back to chapter 18, he says he's going to take the things away from that vain religious system, God's things, he's going to take them back from that vain religious system. And by this point here, he's shown how he's going to take back the nation. He's going to take back the city. He's going to take back the temple. He just shut down the temple, and he's going to take it back for God. And he's going to now, he announces he set up an account for national Israel. And he's put the account not in the name of that vain religious system. He's made the account for national Israel to obtain the national riches of Israel in the name of that believing remnant. And he tells them how to access that account. Just before this, you access the account. See, now how would they have thought to access God's riches before Jesus came on the scene? They'd been taught you got to go to the vain religious system. They're the ones dispensing God's riches. Now Jesus has done away with them. He's shut down the temple. He's taken away everything they stole from God and the nation. And now what do? They're supposed to go to Jesus for that. And he says, now don't go to that vain religious system for the riches of God. You're going to go to the account, Israel's national account, that I'm going to fill up at the cross. And I'm going to put in your name the believing remnant, especially the leaders of that believing remnant, Peter and the 12. And he's going to say, you access that account by faith, prayer, and forgiving. And they could tap into the national riches, and God's going to rebuild the nation through that believing remnant. All right, so they're sitting in Moses' seat, but what's coming out here is they've stolen. This is just another one of the things they stole from God and the nation. They're using it wrongly. They're using it to teach things that aren't right. Going all the way back to Matthew 3, he's been saying one thing, it's separate from that vain religious system and don't listen to anything they say. You have to listen to me, Jesus. And he's been telling that all the way along and leading them through that. And they've taken Moses' seat, as with everything else, and they've used it for their own purposes to maintain their position. And so I think he's using this sarcastically. He just silenced the whole the whole vain religious system. They aren't saying anything. They sit in Moses' seat, and we're not going to, I'm just going to read through these because we covered these last week, but just to kind of get the flow, and we'll pick it up here at verse 13. But in verse 3, they sit in Moses' seat, but don't do the works of God. And you could go back and look at those transfer parables we looked at last week to see how they tie into that one. Verse 4, they sit in Moses' seat, but burden the nation with non-Mosaic teaching and practices. And you can look at the Sabbath, their teaching on the Sabbath, their teaching on cleansing, their teaching the wrong way to handle the law and the traditions of men. Verse 5, they're looking at, they sit in Moses' seat, but instead of being motivated by love of God and others, they are motivated by self-desire to impress others. They want the chief seats and the banquets. They want to be what I think is a good way of saying it, because everybody knows what you're saying. They want to be grand poopas, and they want to walk around in their fancy robes and be the chief people up at the head tables, and the exact opposite, we've learned in Matthew, of a true child of the kingdom who's obedient to the Lord Jesus. Then in verse 6 and 7, he brings out they sit in Moses' seat, but instead of being the meekest of all people like Moses. Remember, in Numbers here, there's an example where Aaron and Miriam are rebelling against Moses. And there's a quote in there that says, Moses was the meekest and mildest of all men. See, their claim to be sitting in Moses' seat, and they're not like Moses at all. They don't teach what he teaches, they don't do what he did, and they're not meek and mild like he was. And they claim to be sitting in Moses' seat. They were status seekers trying to be superior to all. Moses' seat is just another one of God's riches that this vain religious system has stolen away, and he's going to take it away from them. He's going to take the nation away from this vain religious system. He's going to take the city back. He's going to take the temple back. Remember, he said that they were trying to take the kingdom by violence. He's going to take the kingdom back, and he's going to put it in the account of Peter and the 12 and this believing remnant, and they're the ones he's going to use to rebuild the nation. That vain religion, he's all done. And that's what we're going to look at next, with his whole woes. Don't do what the vain religious system has done. Do what Jesus did. Maybe we'll start with that, picking up in these last two verses, and then we'll get into verse 13. Verse 11 and 12 of this section. This is Matthew 23, verse 11. But he that is greatest among you shall be your servant, and whosoever shall exalt himself shall be abased, and he that shall humble himself shall be exalted. So you see what he's doing here. He's using these things, and the kingdom is going to run on a completely different basis than the way the nation's being run on that day. It's not the ones, the vain religious system and the vain political system in Israel at that time were running the nation like the Gentiles run the nations. Jesus said that a little bit earlier. They're running it. They become princes and kings so that they can lord it over other people, make other people their servants. But Jesus said that's not the way the kingdom's going to be run. The kingdom isn't just going to be another Gentile kingdom or nation. The kingdom's going to be run. The princes and the kings in the kingdom are going to be the servants of all. They're going to be the ones serving. See, the kingdom he's bringing out, it's going to be the total flip-flop of the world that they know at that time. It's going to be a total opposite. It's the ones who are servants that are going to be the princes, not the ones who lord it over others and make others their servants. And when he explained that to Peter and the 12 and James and John, they had a hard time understanding it. They've been indoctrinated with the vain religious system, the vain political system, the way the world works. And they're like, we want to be the chief. We want to be the grand poopas in the kingdom. And Jesus just shuts them down. Absolutely, that's not the way the kingdom works. It's the complete opposite. Rather, when Jesus Rather, the believing remnant is to use God's riches the way Jesus used them. And we looked at some of the examples of these last week. Jesus increased the ways a person could please God. Just think of the way the vain religious system uses. Just think of the Sabbath. You know, you can't walk. You can walk 8 steps, but you can't walk a 9th step. Otherwise, you've offended God. You can do this, but you can't do that. You can eat, but you can't cook. You can do. They have all these things. How you can offend God so that everybody's just spending every minute trying to figure out how to not to offend God. Is that the way God wants them to respond to them? No, God wants them to respond to them out of worship and praise to please him. See, Jesus does the exact opposite. He doesn't give them a list of ways they can offend God. He gives them a list of ways they can please God. That's the Beatitudes way back in chapter 5. He gives them all those ways, mercy and forgiveness, kindness, love. He gives them the ways to please God. All the vain religions find ways you can offend God. He gives them the way to please him. He removed their burdens and made their load light. You can look back at Matthew 11 for that. He came humble and meek servant. If there's a prophet like unto Moses, it's not anyone in that vain religious system. It's the Lord Jesus Christ who comes humble and meek. His teachings match his actions, and that pleases God. So you have the woes. Now we start the woes here in verse 13. The woes are the ways to not please God. The Beatitudes from the beginning. Notice the whole book is kind of encased. You got the Beatitudes on one side, and you have the woes on the other side. And the Beatitudes show how to please God. The woes he's going to use now to show how to displease God. And I broke this up into 5 groups here that I call the absurdities of the vain religious system. So let's just read through this. I'm not going to go into every little detail of these things. I think it's more important to get the gist of what he's talking about here. So let's read verses 13 to 15. And here we have the absurdity of the vain religious system with exploitation of others to maintain their own position. He's going to give 3 examples. So let's just read through them here. Verse 13. But woe, condemnation and judgment, woe unto you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for ye neither go in yourselves, neither suffer ye them that are entering to go in. Woe unto you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayer. Therefore ye shall receive the greater damnation. Woe unto you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye compass sea and land to make one proselyte, that's to convert a Gentile into Judaism, to make them a Jew. A proselyte of Gentile is a proselyte is a Gentile who converts to Judaism. Verse 15. To make one proselyte, and when he is made, you make him twofold more the child of hell. You kind of see the progression here from going to the kingdom to the widows. It says here in verse 14, they receive the greater damnation. And then at the end of verse 15, you have the double condemnation, double damnation. And there's this progression. They go and they are using their status, their position, to go out and exploit other people in order to maintain their own position. So the first one is they exploit the kingdom seekers. Verse 13, woe unto you Pharisees and scribes, you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men. Now that is really bad. That's their main fault. But look how he finishes it. For ye neither go in yourselves, neither suffer ye them that are entering to go in. It would have been bad enough that they just rejected Christ and God's kingdom themselves. But they don't just do that, right? They go out, they reject it themselves, they refuse to enter the kingdom, and then they go out and try and keep other people from entering the kingdom. A double condemnation. That's where you'd be one thing if they just refused it and went home and took a nap, but no, they refuse to get up and start coordinating how to keep other people from entering the kingdom, leading them astray. This is supposed to be the religious system that leads. They claim to be leading people to God. And in fact, they're leading people away from God. And we're going to end these three verses. They're leading people to hell. Verse 14, woe unto scribes and Pharisees. Now we're going to see what they do. They exploit the widows through long prayers for pay. Woe unto you scribes and Pharisees, verse 14, for ye devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayer. Therefore ye shall receive greater damnation. So they're refusing to go into the kingdom themselves. They're trying to keep others from going into the kingdom. And then they exploit widows who are in bad situations. They've had a death. They're probably their husband here. Perhaps children have died. They got widows who are in difficult circumstances. And they exploit them. And what are they doing? They're doing one of the reasons, I guess, how we ended up with the Reformation. What did the vain religious system of Christianity do? What, to widows? They'd say, well, you pay us, you give us money, and we'll give you long prayers. We'll pray for them. We'll get them out of purgatory through our prayer, all this kind of nonsense. And that's going on here, way back in Israel's day. They're taking widows who are in extreme situations. They're in dependency, and they're offering these long prayers. And of course, the expectation is the widow would give them her money. And you see, this is just typical. You could apply this to the orphans. You could apply it to all the other needy, the sick and the lame that were excluded from the temple. All these people they're going to take advantage of. And what they should have been doing is supporting them. And they devour widows' houses under the pretense. And we'll say long prayers for the one you lost, your lost loved one, and take advantage of them. Then we see in the next verse, exploitation of the Gentiles. Woe unto you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you compass sea and land. You go around the whole world to make one proselyte, and when he's made, you make him twofold more the child of hell than yourselves. Now, if you want to know the status of the Gentiles, go to the last half of Ephesians 2 and you'll learn it. They were completely hopeless. They had no hope of their own. They were apart from Christ, apart from the covenant. Were out there, and they're in a hopeless situation of their own. And they're in a hopeless situation of their own. And now you have the Jews, the religious leaders of Israel, they're supposed to be the ones who come and enlighten the Gentiles. The Gentiles are out in darkness. They're supposed to be bringing light to the Gentiles. And instead they go out, they're steering people away. They refuse to enter the kingdom. They steer people away from the kingdom. They misuse their own people, especially those who are dependent. And they go out and the Gentiles, they offer them to be participating in this vain religious system. And they make the Gentiles twice as bad as they were before, which was pretty bad. More the child of hell than yourselves. Make him twofold more the child of hell. He was a child of hell already. Now he's twofold child of hell. And he just leads them. This is the system that's supposed to enlighten the Gentiles, lead the Gentiles to the one true God. And they're leading them astray, away from God. They're making them even darker than they were before. Absurdity of the vain religious system, but with their exploitation of others to maintain their own position. Exploiting the Gentiles, making them worse than they were before, claiming to steer them to God while really leading them away from God and hell. All right, let's look at the next absurdity. Absurdity of the vain religious system and oath-making. Now, it's important to realize Chapter 23 just didn't drop out of the clear blue sky. It comes after, I'm pretty sure, if I remember my grammar school arithmetic, it comes after chapter 5 and 6. And you know what Matthew said in 5 and 6? He said in the kingdom, they're not going to be making oaths. You're not to make oaths or vows and swearing, not in the way we use swearing, but swearing in the sense of making an oath, in the kingdom. The kingdom doesn't need that. In the kingdom, people are going to say on the outside what they mean on the inside. And what's oath-taking? Oath-taking, well, when do you see it usually? In a courtroom, right? Because people think that if you put your hand on the Bible and swear by the Bible, that then you're going to tell the truth because you're going to otherwise fall under the wrath of God. Of course, most people who do that don't have any respect for that anyway. But that's what oath-making is. You come along, and they're not even going to have oath-making in the kingdom because what they say on the outside is going to be what they mean on the inside. They don't need to make oaths. Why? When do we usually make oaths? Let's all be truthful. We usually make oaths when we want to deceive someone, right? I did something wrong, but I don't want you to know it, and I want to deny it. So I'll say something like today, I'll swear on a Bible. I didn't do it. Because I'm covering up, I'm trying to deceive. Maybe I'd say if I really, really want to make the point and make it look like I'm innocent and didn't do what I really did, I might say, I'm gonna swear on a stack of Bibles. Now you see, I really, really mean it. Well, just keep that in mind. And when we read through this, when it says they were told, this vain religious system told them, you know, go ahead and swear on the temple. That won't hold you, bind you to anything. Just don't swear on the gold of the temple. It's kind of like swearing on one Bible. You know, God's wrath won't come down on you if you break that oath or you're lying in saying that. Just don't swear on a stack of Bibles because now God's wrath might come down on you. And he's going to say that. I just wanted to prepare this because this passage can be a little bit confusing just to read through. So he's going to come along and kind of think of the one Bible versus a stack of Bible. It's okay, they're going to say, if you want to break your vow, if you're being deceptive, do a vow on the temple, not on the gold in the temple. If you want to make an oath and not keep it, well, then vow on the altar. Don't vow on the gift on the altar. And he's going to go through all these things, and he's going to show the absolute absurdity of it. And keeping in mind, we've already learned in Matthew 5 and 6, they're not even going to make oaths in the kingdom. Because what they say on the inside is going to be what they mean on the outside. What they say on the outside is what they mean on the inside. All right, so now with that little bit of background, let's go ahead and pick it up at verse 16. Woe unto you, you blind guides, which say, whosoever shall swear by the temple, it is nothing. But whosoever shall swear by the gold of the temple, he is a debtor. He has to keep his promise. He has to keep his vow. Verse 17, ye fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And the obvious answer is it's the temple that sanctifies. The only reason the gold's important is because it's in the temple. The temple sanctifies the gold. But what did the vain religious system care about? Were they caring about God's temple, or were they caring about their gold? They wanted their gold. They didn't care about the temple. Jesus just shut down the temple in the chapter before this and took it away from them. What they didn't care about God and his temple. They cared about the gold in the temple. That was their livelihood. That's what kept them going. That's what kept the treasures God meant for the nation, and they kept for themselves. He gives another example here. Verse 18, and whosoever shall swear by the altar. Now that's God's thing, the altar. It is nothing, but whosoever swears by the gift that is upon it is guilty. You fools and blind, for what? Which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies it? Whosoever therefore shall swear by the altar swears by it and all the things therein. Now, let's just kind of get the flow here again. Hopefully, I set it up in a common parlance with a one Bible versus a stack of Bibles. That's kind of what he's getting here. It's okay if you swear, if you're not going to keep your oath and you want to deceive, then you swear on the temple because that's not binding. You don't have to worry about God's wrath coming upon you. But if you are going to keep the oath, if you swear on the gold in the temple and you break your oath and you don't keep your oath, well, now that is important. That will bring the wrath of God. If you swear on the altar, that's not binding. Don't have to worry about it. You can be lying. That's okay. But if you swear on the gift, the sacrifice on the altar, now why would they say that? You can just see how this culminates. What Jesus is doing here, he's bringing this to such a huge culmination. They don't care about the things of God. They care about their own things. They don't care about the temple. Yeah, make an oath on that. It's not binding. Don't worry about it. Don't make an oath on our things, the gold in the temple, because we take that. That's the thing that's important to this vain religious system. They didn't care about God's thing, the temple. They cared about the gold in the temple. They didn't care about God's thing, the altar. Yeah, make a vow on that and it won't bind you. But don't make it on the gift on the altar. Now, what was the gift on the altar? It was that sacrifice, right? And what's that sacrifice going to be for these, for the vain religious system? It's dinner tonight. They're going to eat that sacrifice. Don't vow on that. Don't make a vow on the gold. The important things of God didn't matter. It was just what was important to them. They didn't care about the temple or the altar, God's things. They cared about the gold in the temple, which they were stealing, and they cared about the sacrifice on the altar, which they were going to have for dinner that night. And he says, it's just an absurdity. What sanctifies the gold, what sanctifies the sacrifice, isn't just them that they sanctify themselves. They're sanctified because they're in God's temple on God's altar. You can't separate them. The vain religious system has turned everything upside down. They value the things that aren't important and they don't consider the things that are important, God's things. And Jesus shows the absurdity of this, because what makes the gift on the altar or the gold in the temple set apart isn't anything else but that it's in God's temple, on God's altar. And then he takes it a step further. Look at verse 20. 21. And whosoever, he's going to go a step further now. It's not the gold and the sacrifice. It's the temple and the altar. And now he's going to go a step further. But even the temple and the altar aren't the ultimate thing. The ultimate thing in verse 21. And whosoever shall swear by the temple sweareth by it and by him that dwelleth therein. They were trying to separate out the temple from the gold, the altar from the sacrifice, the things of God and their things, and they were trying to separate that. They were trying to protect these, and they didn't care about those. But Jesus says, that's why I use the word absurdity. It's absurd. It's just religious nonsense, because the only reason that gold and that sacrifice is sanctified is because they're on God's altar and God's temple, and in that temple belongs and dwells God. So if you make an oath based on the gold in the altar or gold in the temple or the temple itself, you're actually making an oath on God, because he's the one that dwells in that temple. If you make an oath based on the sacrifice on the altar or the altar, what you're doing in both cases is making an oath based on God. His point is, they're deceptive practices, they're lies to cover up things, isn't fooling anybody. Any of those things are going to bring the wrath of God. Thus, the woe here. Let's finish in the last verse having to do with this one, verse 22. And he that shall swear by heaven sweareth by the throne of God and by him that sitteth thereon. It all culminates in God himself. Swearing on it, the whole world belongs to God. Maybe we should go back and read Matthew 5. Or is it Matthew 6? I guess it's Matthew 6. Oh, Matthew 5:33. And you'll see how he puts this all together. Especially, you might not pick up the gist of what he's talking about in Matthew 23 that we just read if you didn't already know Matthew 5. So let's just read through it, through Matthew 5, and you'll see what he's talking about. Now he's talking about how the kingdom is going to be ruled. Verse 33. Again, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. And now you get an expanded thing in Matthew 23 of what the vain religious said with regard to forswearing yourself and how to do that. The whole gold and sacrifice versus the temple and the altar. But look what he says here in verse 34. But I say unto you, swear not at all. Neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for the city of the great king, neither shalt thou swear by the head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But here's what the vain religious system was trying to cover up. This is what they weren't doing. But this is what's going to be going on in the kingdom. But, verse 37, let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay. Let what you say on the outside match what's true on the inside. That's what oath-making tries to cover up. It allows you to try and deny you've done something or deceive someone into something by covering up under swearing on the temple or swearing on the altar or swearing on the gold. And you're going to fool people into deceiving people into thinking you're telling the truth. You're saying on the outside what you really think on the inside. And it's complete failure. And Jesus back in Matthew 23, we can head back there, he's saying, you're not fooling anyone. Because it's not about really about the gold and the sacrifice. That's the things that were important to the vain religious system, because that's the money they're going to live off and the food they're going to eat. It's not even necessarily the temple and the altar. It's the fact that God dwells in that temple. God dwells in the heavens on his throne. And whatever you oath take, it's ultimately an oath on God and would thus call down the wrath of God, and thus, woe, you Pharisees and scribes. All right, go to the next absurdity. This is all upside down, the temple and altar and heaven sanctify the gold and the gift and the throne, and they're all sanctified by God. All right. Let's look at the seventh, it's the third absurdity, and this is the absurdity that the vain religious system is doing, and notice my quotation marks, doing the law. Look at verse 23 to 28. Now he's going to talk about how the scribes and the Pharisees, who are what? They are the law experts. They're the ones who are supposed to be experts in the law. They have absconded with Moses' seat. They've stolen that way from God. They're using it for their own things, but they're supposed to be experts on Moses' law. And look what, could you get anything more fundamental for the nation of Israel than Moses' law? But look what how they're teaching, how they're using Moses' law. Verse 23, woe unto you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought you to have done and not to leave the other undone. Ye blind guides, which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. Woe unto you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you make clean the outside of the cup and of the platter, but within they are full of extortion and excess, thou blind Pharisees. Thy blind Pharisee, cleanse first that which is within the cup and platter, that the outside of them may be clean as well. And we'll just break in there, because you have there the two major things that the absurdity of the vain religious system. These are supposed to be the experts. They're the ones telling all the people how they can avoid offending God. That's the whole argument here. They don't tell them how to please God. They just tell them how they'll offend God. So they can spend they can count cumin seeds all day long, so they don't miss one when they're tithing, but they forget all about righteousness, justice, love, faith, mercy. They focus on the little things. Now, some people think that there's an actual progression here, and that these seeds that Jesus is talking about don't even need to be tithed, because they don't fall into the basic category in the Mosaic law. And so if you understand it that way, here they are tithing things that don't even need to be tithed. They're completely ignoring the things, the great things of the law, like mercy, justice, faith, and love. And they should be focused on that. And the little things of the law he throws in. He's not throwing out the little things of the law, but the little things of the law as well. So if we had to summarize this, it just goes to show their focus. They don't know anything about the law. We've seen that all the way through here. They're supposed to be the experts. They don't know anything about the law. They missed the ingredient earlier. I think it was Matthew 12. They missed the concept of that God implements the law in mercy. They completely missed out on that. And just in the last chapter, we saw that God implements the law. The key ingredient of the law is love. And they completely missed out on that. They don't know anything about the law. And here they are stressing either things that aren't even included, they've just added it to the law themselves, or if you think these are things that needed to be tied, the minutia of that, and they forget the great things. And then he goes to the next one where you have the outer and inner cup. That should remind you something from our Sermon on the Mount. Remember back, we won't turn back there again, but remember there, what does he say? He gives chapters 5 and 6, he gives all these examples. You have heard it said, thou shalt not commit murder. What's murder? An external act, right? But I say, thou shalt not commit or be angry in your hearts. Or you've already committed murder. What does he say another time? He says, you have heard it said, thou shalt not commit adultery, the external act. But I say, if thou hast lusted in thine heart, you've already committed adultery. Here's the other thing they were doing. They were not only focusing on the minutia or the things that weren't even in the law and ignoring the great things of the law. They were also focusing on the external things of the law and ignoring the internal things of the law. See, that's what they missed. They thought they could regulate people and get them to stop committing murders and adultery. They thought they could handle that. But Jesus explains, no, the only way you're going to get rid of murder and adultery is by fixing the heart. That's the only way. If you try to handle murder and adultery without dealing with anger and lust, it's going to be hopeless. What needed to happen is they need to have a heart change. And if you were not angry in the heart, guess what? You've already taken care of thou shalt not murder. You're not going to murder. If you remove lust from the heart, you've already dealt with the external act of adultery. It all comes back to the heart. And that's what in chapter 23 here, they were focusing on the outside of the cup or the platter, while inside it was full of corruption. They don't care about that. That's what Jesus was saying back in the Sermon on the Mount. You're trying to regulate murder and adultery when you should be regulating anger and lust in the heart and return to a heart of faith so those things can be dealt with. And then the external things will automatically take care of themselves. They'll just go away. That's what they're missing. They don't understand anything about the law. They focus on the minutiae and ignore the great things, and they focus on the external and ignore the internal. They don't know anything about it. And now he gets to them personally. Look at verse 27. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye are like unto whited sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outward, but are within full of dead man's bones and of all uncleanness. Now he goes right down to them, the absurdity of them doing the law. They haven't dealt with the most important, fundamental thing. Here, you want an interdispensational truth? Here's an interdispensational truth. The most fundamental, most necessary thing in any dispensation, in any time, for any sinner born into this world from the fall of Adam to the last sinner born, is faith righteousness. You need to have a heart of faith. And then everything else flows out of that. Anything done any other way. And here they had the externals. Externally, they looked, had an appearance of being God's spokesmen, God's teachers, God's experts, God's conduit of God's things. And inside, they were just corruption. There was unbelief. All right, so that's the absurdity, that the vain religious system is doing the law. They focused on the little and external. They should have been focusing on the great and the internal. And we kind of added from the Sermon on the Mount on that. Now, the next absurdity of the vain religious system claiming to be the children of the prophets. So let's read that. That's verses 29 to 36. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous. And say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Now, everybody really should chuckle a little there. That's what they're saying. What have they already done? They've already put John the Baptist to death. And what were they planning on doing? What were they already planning out? How they could put Jesus to death. And now they claim to be of their fathers. They wouldn't be like their fathers who killed the prophets. And they're doing the exact same thing. They've already done away with John, and they're going to do, they're plotting how to get rid of Jesus, and it's going to be in a couple days here. And the vain religious system is going to join hands with that vain political system and putting the Lord Jesus Christ on that cross. So they say in verse 30, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets, when in fact they've already participated in that and we're plotting the next one. Wherefore, verse 31, be ye witnesses unto yourselves that ye are the children of them which killed the prophets. They're really the children of the not of the prophets. They were trying to make it look like they were the children of the prophets, when in fact they were the children of those who killed the prophets. Verse 32, fill ye up then the measure of your fathers, and they're going to do that on that cross with Jesus. Verse 33, ye serpents, ye generation of vipers, how can you escape the damnation of hell? Wherefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them shall kill, and you shall kill and crucify, and some shall you scourge in your synagogues and persecute them from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel unto the blood of Zacharias, son of Berechias, whom ye slew between the temple and the altar. Verily, I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation. And there you have it. That ends the woes, their absurdity of them being part of this vain religious system, claiming to be the children of the prophets, when they're really the children of those who killed the prophets. They're just like their fathers. They're carrying on that line. And then he expands it. This is really critical to see because most of historic Christianity has really gone off the rails with this. But now he expands this now. And he talks about, he goes from the idea of them being the children of the ones who killed the prophets. And then he expands that now. They're the generation of vipers. And what's a generation? What's the viper? Well, first we should probably start with viper. Where do you first read about a snake, a serpent? This is the serpent. Remember in the Garden of Eden? The serpent that caused the fall of humanity, brought about the fall of humanity. And there's been a generation beginning with Cain that's been going all the way, and it's going to go all the way to the return of Christ. That's this generation of vipers. The generation, the snake, the serpent, Satan generated. Very important to understand the word generation. Now, I know we all watch the so-called prophecy teachers and all that, and they all come to this passage, and they talk about a generation being a 30 or 40 or 50-year period. Nobody really knows. They all come up with different things depending on what they're trying to make it look like. They can look into the future and see. But this has nothing to do with a 30 or 40, 50-year period. The word, when Matthew uses the word generation, he's talking about the generation, what generated a line of people. Just go back to Matthew 1, and we'll see how he uses this word generation. Matthew 1. Look at the very first verse. And here you want your definition of generation. Matthew 1, verse 1. The book of the generation of Jesus Christ. Here we have the book of the generation of Jesus Christ. Now, is he just talking here? Pretend you hadn't seen this verse before. What comes after this? Is this going to be Joseph and Mary and the people in Jesus' generation at that time, that 30, 40, 50-year period, that generation? Absolutely not. What is it? He brings it with the son of David and the son of Abraham. This is a generation that began way back with Abraham. A generation of people, a line of people generated from the faith of Abraham, and it's going to go all the way to the Lord Jesus Christ. It's not just the people in his generation, that what we would think of as a 30, 40, 50-year period. It's the people that have been generated from the line of Abraham through Isaac and Jacob leading to the Lord Jesus Christ. When he talks about this generation of vipers, it's not the evil, wicked leaders of that 30 or 40-year period. It's the wicked, evil leaders that go all the way back to Cain. And that generation has just been going on and on and on and on. It's not a 30 or 40 or 50 year period. It's something generated from Satan. It's a line of fallen, a line of humanity that's rejected God and here his Christ at this point. It's a generation that comes from the line of Cain. And when he says, therefore, go back to Matthew 23. Matthew 23. So now when he says in verse 36, verily I say unto you, these things shall come upon this generation, with that information and with the context where he just tells you what kind of generation, it's a generation generated from the serpent, from Satan, he's not referring to the people in this 30 or 40 year period is going to see these things, are going to be there for these things. What he's talking about is that generation that started back at Cain has been keep going on. It's going to keep going on. Maybe we should go back to here. Keep going on and on. It began all the way back there with Cain, and it's been going on and on and on. It's what brought Israel into those courses of punishment and the curses of the law. It's been going on and on. It's going to be what put John the Baptist to death, what put Christ to death. It's going to be what the persecution at Pentecost, and then it's going to be picked up again when God restarts his program with the nation of Israel, and it's going to go on through there. And it's not this generation that began all the way back with Cain isn't going to be destroyed until Christ's second coming. And then it's going to be destroyed once and for all. All these woes we've just been reading about, they're all going to reach, not, they're not going to be fulfilled in the 30 or 40 year period that Matthew, the generation in that sense. It's going to be fulfilled on the generation that goes all the way back to Cain and is here and is going to go through this tribulation and is going to be destroyed at the second coming of Christ. That's where the final destruction of the generation of Satan through Cain, that began with Cain. And it's going to reach that point, and it's going to see all these things will come upon it. Not what most of historic Christianity says. They read generation in all the book of Matthew. It never refers to a 30 or 40 year period. It always talks about a line of people. And they come in this one instance, they read, and oh, this must mean a 30 or 40 year period. And then, you know, you get all kinds of wacky prophecy stuff where they go to the date in 1947 with the reestablishment of Israel as a nation. So it must be 30 years. Well, and then 30 years came. Well, the generation must be 40 years or 50 years. And of course, now 40, 50 years have gone by. I don't even know anymore how they're spinning it. But that's not what he's saying here. This generation is this generation that goes back to Cain, goes back to the fathers of Israel that killed the prophets, the generation that did all that, and they're going to keep going. This should also remind us of a couple parables. Remember the parable of the wheat and the tares and the good and the bad fish? They're not going to be separated. They're not going to be dealt with until Christ returns. Then the bad fish and the tares are going to be thrown into the fire, and the wheat and the good fish are going to be ushered into that kingdom. That generation is the generation. It's not a 30 or 40 or 50 year period. I have to repeat that a couple times because people think it is, and then they fall for the ploys of all these would-be prophecy teachers, and it's just a bunch of nonsense. He's talking about, just as he refers to Jesus' generation as going back to Abraham, and you know what Luke is going to do? He goes to the generation of Jesus and takes it all the way back to Adam. That's the generation they're talking about, not what we would typically refer to as a 30 or 40 or 50 or whatever year period. And that's what he's going back to. This generation that began with Cain, that the fathers that persecuted the prophets were participating in, and that the vain religious system is still participating in Jesus' day, that generation that began way back then, it's going to keep going, and it's going to witness all these things at the second coming of Christ. All right. That's when these woes are going to be brought down upon there. We have one more absurdity. I won't even take the time to flip there. I'm not even going to read the verses. We'll open this next time. The final absurdity is claiming that the temple and Jerusalem belong to them. We've just seen he's shut down the temple, and he's going to reclaim it, the temple and Jerusalem, for himself. And take it away from the vain religious system, and he's going to give it to the nation of Israel as represented with this believing remnant.